Back to our psalm, verse 39. He remembered that they were but flesh, a breath of air that passes and doesn't come again. God realizes how frail we are, fragile. We're like a leaf in autumn. It doesn't take much to pluck us off the tree and face. So God knows we're like that. Here, Psalm 39, verse 5, my span of years is short, my lifetime is as nothing in your sight. Surely everyone stands as a mere breath, a hebel, puff. Surely everyone goes about like a shadow. And when the sun goes, the shadow vanishes. And the older we get, isn't it true? The shorter life seems, and the quicker years go. And the more close friends around us are dying, and brothers and sisters and spouses, and there's no one in the generation, etc. I mean, that's the way it works. So we realize how fragile our life here is. And that's when the resurrection comes in as a wonderful, amazing openness. Kohelet, that's the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3. The fate of humans and the fate of animals is the same. One dies, well, so does the other. They've all the same breath. Humans have no advantage over the animals, for all is vanity. All go to one place. All are but dust, and all go back to dust. Now he describes the rebellion in three verses, verse 40. How often they rebelled against him in the wilderness and grieved him in the desert. They tested God again and again. Remember Jesus' words, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test, quoting from the book of Deuteronomy, which is commenting on the same stuff. They tested God again and again. They provoked the Holy One of Israel. They did not keep in mind his power, or the day when he redeemed them from their foe. And then he runs through the plagues of Egypt. But interestingly, see, the book of Exodus, was the book of Exodus finalized after this psalm was written? Could be. Don't presume everything's very logical and time. So when you run through this psalm, which talks about the same plagues, basically, not all of them, and you look through the book of Exodus, you'll find they're not in the same order at all. Well, they probably had different varieties, different schools. They hadn't logically sorted it all out, and good that they hadn't, because it never was historically logical. Let's have a look. And you can see where the references are to the book of Exodus and the plagues of Egypt that you'll hear about or read about there. They're all natural phenomena, by the way, except the last one, which I'll explain to you. But they're all things that happen in all parts of the world. So they take these plagues, these dreadful things that happen, like windstorms and earthquakes and, you know, hail that destroys the crops and diseases, and that's all they're talking about. They're talking about ordinary things that everyone experiences and seeing them as a punishment for God. So they have them in a big scale happen back in Egypt. They copped it worse than anybody. Did they? Go out any part of the world. All right. He displayed his signs in Egypt and his miracles in the fields of Zoan. We had that earlier. He turned their rivers to blood so that they couldn't drink of the streams. I've got a whole series of lectures on the book of Exodus that are on it on disc if you want. The book of Exodus is the most important book of the Old Testament, I believe. And if you ever wanted to, I can't do it here with you, but I go right through the book of Exodus, doing my best to share with you whatever scholarship tells us about it. So he turned their rivers to blood so that they couldn't drink of their streams. He sent among them swarms of flies which devoured them and frogs which destroyed them. He gave their crops to the caterpillar and the fruit of their labor to the locust. He destroyed the vines with hail and their sycamores with frost. He gave over the cattle to the hail and their flocks to thunderbolts. First plague, fourth plague, second plague, eighth plague, seventh plague, fifth plague, all in there, jumbled around, all these wonderful stories that they heard about what God did to the Egyptians. Not to us, thank God, but to the Egyptians. Continuing. He let loose on them his fierce anger, wrath, indignation, and distress, a company of destroying angels. He made a path for his anger. He didn't spare them from death, gave their lives over to the plague. He struck all the firstborn in Egypt, the first issue of their strength in the tents of Ham. Ham is the Seth and Ham and the sons of Noah, as that was their early geography, and Egypt belongs to that lot. Well, that's what God did. That's the only one that's not a natural phenomenon, and of course it's not real. All the firstborn of the Egyptian men were killed. Huh? Yeah, and all the firstborn of the horses and the cattle and the, every firstborn and male, something about being a woman, you seem to escape all these things, all through Egypt were killed. Well, can you, I mean, just picture to yourself, what would God be doing going up into northern Egypt or southern Egypt or out into thing and killing just the firstborn calf and the firstborn horse? I mean, you don't believe that, do you? Oh, there we are. Thank you, Judith. So the point of this story is, see, the Egyptians thought of themselves as God's firstborn. They were the great nation. They were the America, the policeman of the world, the, you know what I mean? The sacred nation in some Americans' view. Of course, not all, but you know what I mean? The way it looks like a... So they were the great nation of the ancient world right through. So they were God's firstborn. They looked at themselves as that way. This psalm is saying, no. God rejected them. They are not God's firstborn. The firstborn of God is Israel. The Hebrews, the slaves, the poor, the broken. Do you get it? God's firstborn meaning the ones who inherit God's promises. So it's a symbol thing. It's not a geographical or historical fact. They did a market research all through Egypt and found it, oh, isn't amazing? Only the firstborn horses were killed and all the others were alive. It's nothing like that. It's saying, no, we are God's firstborn, not the Egyptians. And that's what the story is saying in a beautifully powerful, dramatic way, but awfully deceptive if you took it literally, because you're not meant to take poetry literally. Israel, Sirach 36:17. Whom you have named your firstborn.
Does not this like a literal or a figurative?
You. So verse 52 to 55, I'll just read this part. Then he, this is the main parable, the image. He led them out his people like sheep. He guided them in the wilderness like a flock. He led them in safety so that they were not afraid. But the sea overwhelmed their enemies, and he brought them to this, his holy hill. Here we are in Judah now. And to the mountain that his right hand had won, he drove out nations before them. He apportioned them not for a possession and settled the tribes of Israel in their tents. That's historically not true. They didn't chase anybody out. The people, some of them converted to Yahwehism a little bit, some converted a lot. There was no massive murder of the Jews, of the Israelites coming in, and that's, you'd think there was if you read the book of Judges and Joshua, but archaeology has shown it just simply never happened. So this is presentation to get values, not history. Yet they tested the Most High God. They rebelled against him. They didn't observe his decrees, but turned away and were faithless like their ancestors. They twisted like a treacherous bow. What a great image. The bow, you know, and the arrow goes in the wrong direction. They provoked him to anger with their high places, and they moved him to jealousy with their idols. And when God heard, he was full of wrath. He utterly rejected Israel. He abandoned his dwelling at Shiloh. Shiloh is a little bit north of Bethel, right in the middle of Ephraim, where the ark first was before Jerusalem was captured by David, going right back into the time of the Judges. He abandoned his dwelling at Shiloh, the tent where he dwelled. He delivered its power to captivity, its boasting to the hand of the foe. He gave his people to the sword and vented his wrath on his heritage. Fire devoured their young men, their girls had no marriage song. Their priests fell by the sword, and their widows made no lamentation. See, he's going back to the time in their story, which is handed down, so there's truth behind it. It's ultimately based on events, where the Philistines... and you doing it all. Do you get it? Not the Philistines, but God. Because it happened. God must have intended it, according to their understanding. Then the Lord awoke as from a sleep, like a warrior shouting because of wine. He put his adversaries to rout. He put them to everlasting disgrace. He rejected the tents of Joseph. This is the collapse of the northern kingdom. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim. He chose the tribe of Judah. That's us who are writing the psalm. The Mount Zion, which he loves. He built his sanctuary like the high heavens, like the earth, which he has founded forever. He chose his servant David and took him from the sheepfolds, from tending the nursing ewes. He brought him out to be a shepherd of his people, Jacob, of Israel, his inheritance. With upright heart he tended them. He guided them with a skillful hand. So there's our psalm ending. We are the chosen ones, and you've seen it all. So God has been beautiful to us. They've all been rejected. Don't forget it. Because if they were chosen and they were rejected, we could be rejected too. So, says the psalm, listen to God, behave God, let God's compassion fall over you. Ultimately, it's saying something really beautiful. But if you bring your logical to mind to bear on it, you've got a few problems.